We're talking about the idea of unity and diversity, that when a God, such as the God is described in the Bible, brought forth a creation, created a creation, he made something that was less than himself, but in like kind, having unity and diversity in its being. In the same way that you have a problem with the idea of personality, if God is an infinite impersonal, as in Eastern religions, how did that infinite impersonal bring about the personal? It's a problem, because we always think of personality as being greater than impersonality, that you are greater than the chair, that you're greater than a rock, or greater than a plant. We always think of it that way, we respond to it intuitively that way. But the question is that true? And in Eastern religions, you've got the idea that, In Eastern religions, you've got the idea that an impersonal has brought forth the personal, which is inconsistence, like water flowing uphill. The effect is greater than the cause, you see, rather than the other way around, which is the way we always experience it, cause greater than effect. Okay? Here, in Christianity, it makes sense because you've got the cause is greater than the effect, and yet is in like kind. So it's not making something that is different, it's only making something that is less in magnitude than itself. And it makes sense to say that a personal God has brought forth personal beings. It's not inconsistent. Okay? The personal can produce the personal and the impersonal, but the impersonal cannot produce the personal. The idea? It's going uphill that way. So then, when we talk about unity and diversity, the problem in Eastern religions goes like this. If we say, in Christianity, if we say that God made something to have unity and diversity, and he has it in his being, then it makes sense, philosophically. If you say that unity and diversity have come from simple unity, it does not make sense, philosophically. You have to eventually end up denying the reality of diversity somewhere along the way, because the unity can only bring forth what is unified. It can't bring forth something that is, if it could bring forth anything at all, that's another question. Bringing forth something gives the idea of something that's separate to start with, and that's a diversity, and that's the problem. Okay? But if the unity brought forth unity and diversity, you eventually have to deny the diversity. But you see, you get all the same problems when you deny diversity in that fashion that we do when we deny absolutes in humanism. Because if you deny absolutes, you deny categories. If you deny categories, you deny opposites. And you've got all the same problems philosophically with Eastern religions as you do with humanism. See? Remember that? We saw you get relativized existence, you get relativized morality, and relativized knowledge. You don't know if you can really know or not, or if things are right or wrong, okay? Or if things really exist in themselves. See why in Eastern religions, you have all those same questions. Relativized existence. If everything is a unity, and there's no diversity, then everything must be the same as the unity that it came from. Can't be different, so it must be God. Now let's take it from there. Everything is God. You are God, the chair is God, the plant is God. Your essence is all the same. So what has happened? Your categories have all been broken down. There is no difference between the personal and the impersonal. The personal is God, the impersonal is God. And so there are no distinctions. Then the question you will have is things like this. If I am real, and I dream, and I think that my dreams are not real, how can I tell that I am any more real than the dreams that I dream? If there are no categories and there's no diversity, maybe the dreams are just as real as I am, or both of us are an illusion. Okay? No categories, you can't make distinctions like that. You can't say real, non-real, reality, illusion. Can't do that. And so what you have is everything must be an illusion. Or at least you can't know if anything is really real. So it's as good as being an illusion. See where that kind of thinking comes from? Comes from their idea of God. It flows logically, philosophically from their idea of God. I'm going to go over this a number of times, a number of ways, so you'll start to get it. Unity and diversity is a fact, and we can't get around it. It is the way things are. I sense that this chair is a unit, and yet at the same time there are the different parts. I sense that my body is a unit, and yet at the same time there are different parts. The tree is a unit, at the same time there are different parts. We cannot get around that fact of reality. And we have to ask the question, where has this come from? And any answer that does not satisfy that is an insufficient philosophical answer, because as Meg was saying during the break, everything that we experience is in some kind of a system of unity and diversity. Everything. And so to ask the question, where has everything come from, is also to ask the question, did it have unity and diversity in its being? Because if it didn't have unity and diversity in its being, you've got to explain somehow where this diversity came from that we experience in the creation. Everything we experience is involved in systems of unity and diversity. So, if it didn't come from a being that has unity and diversity in it or its or his being, then we have to explain, where did this diversity come from? And what happens in Eastern religions is, they say, no, the being that it has come from is an infinite, impersonal, with no differentiation in its being. An undifferentiated whole, they will commonly call it. And this doctrine, this idea that God is one, an undifferentiated, infinite, impersonal, is called monism. It's a good word for you to learn. So when somebody talks about a monistic view of God, you know what they're talking about. An infinite, impersonal, that has only unity in its being and no diversity. Monism, coming from the word mono, one. One essence, no diversity. Okay? And this infinite impersonal has brought forth somehow this unity and diversity, and eventually what you must do is deny the diversity because it doesn't follow philosophically. You must deny it in one way or another. Now, I already gave you a little bit of that reasoning. I'll go through it again. If this unity has brought forth things that appear to have unity and diversity, the question is it just an appearance of diversity, or is it real? And if it is real, then we have to ask the question, how did it come from a simple unity? Okay? And that can't be answered. Okay? Philosophically, it's not sufficient. And so what they'll always do is deny the diversity in one way or another because it doesn't fit philosophically. And so they'll say things like this, everything is God, you are God, the chair is God, everything has one essence. It can't have different essences because the God that it comes from only has one essence. If God only has one essence, the creation can only have one essence. Creation, right, can only have one essence. So if everything is all one essence, where do you stop and the chair starts if everything is God? I mean, even the air in between. If there's air in between you and the chair, that's God too. And so if everything is God, then there is no diversity. Everything must be one big mash. Got that? If there is no diversity and everything is one, see, then you have to deny the diversity if God is one and God has produced something that is only one. Because how did this God, this infinite impersonal unity, produce something that was diversified? Philosophically, that doesn't follow. Are you beginning to get the idea? Okay? So they will deny diversity at some point. And once you deny diversity, you've denied it all, not just in the realm of existence, such as, are you an illusion or are you real? Are you different from the chair? Is there real personality and real impersonality? You deny all diversity. There is a popular Eastern guru who says things like this. This is his phrase, all dualities must be dropped. What does he mean by that? Anything that is diversity must be eliminated, good and evil. What does that come from? Diversity. See, it's an expression of diversity. Existence and non-existence, reality and illusion. See? Knowledge and ignorance, it's all got to be eliminated. All dualities must be dropped. Okay. Now, what I did when I was faced with that situation in a meditation center in Amsterdam, what I did with that was I did this. I said, now you say that all dualities must be dropped. And the guy said, yes. I said, if that's true, then the duality, the difference between good and evil, or pain and non-pain, all of that must be dropped. And the man said, yes, that's true. And I said, you mean then that it really doesn't make any difference if people are starving in Cambodia, starving to death, and if 2 million or however many million people it was died under the Khmer Rouge there, it doesn't make any difference that those people are starving and dying, because there is no difference between pain and non-pain. There is no difference between existence and non-existence. And he said, all dualities must be dropped. And I kept pressing that point, you know, from an intuitive sense. I was working on the basis of his intuitive understanding of right and wrong. See? I said, you mean it makes no difference if people kill little children? It makes no difference if I were to shoot you or if I let you live? That makes no difference at all, because all dualities must be dropped, whether you exist or don't, whether I'm good or evil, makes no difference at all. And he kept saying, all dualities must be dropped. And there finally came one point, and it must have been the Holy Spirit or something, I used an illustration that struck him so deeply in his intuitions about good and evil that he sat there and I could see from his face the internal struggle that was going on. His philosophy didn't fit with his heart. It just didn't fit. And I could see that going on inside. And then he hardened himself and he said, all dualities must be dropped. And from that point on, the conversation went downhill. We couldn't talk anymore because he had hardened himself. In order to save his philosophy, he had hardened himself against his heart, against his intuitive senses of right and wrong. He'd gone against his conscience. See? He said, all dualities must be dropped. And from that point, it just went downhill. Also at that point, all the people were coming in for their time of meditation, if you could call it that, or group therapy or whatever it was. They were all coming in for their time of meditation, and things were building up spiritually, and I could feel the brother who was sitting next to me speaking a little bit louder in tongues, I thought, because he was praying for me the whole time. And things started getting heavier spiritually. And I stood up, and most of these people spoke English, saying. And I stood up, and I said to... I noticed while I was speaking, there was a girl who was watching very intently, and she was very quiet. And as I stood up, I said to the group that was around me, because they were listening to the conversation, I said, you mean it really makes no difference to you in your philosophy if people die in Cambodia? It makes no difference to you if children are born deformed, if people are diseased, or if they kill one another? Because all dualities must be dropped. It makes no difference at all. I said, thank you, but I wouldn't want any kind of a philosophy or a God like that. And there was a guy behind me who started swearing at me. I couldn't believe the epithets came out of his mouth. There were other people who started laughing at me. And they just laughed or swore or did something like that because they had to do something with what I was saying. But this one girl was very quiet as we walked out. And when we got back, we found out that my wife and another guy had been interceding for us, and the Lord had shown them that there was someone who was listening, and they kept praying for this guy who was listening, who was paying attention, but was not really believing, you know, was understanding what I was saying, and was not really going along with what the group thought. And they kept praying for this guy, and they kept feeling uncomfortable when they would pray. And then they said, well, what's wrong, God? And God said, it's a girl. And they went, oh, okay, God. So they started praying for this girl who wasn't paying attention, see? And then we got back. That became an important thing, see, when we got back. So it wasn't a guy. It was a girl who was paying attention. And she, when we got up, didn't respond the way the rest of them did. She was very seriously in thought when we left. So the thing is, this diversity is something, the idea of the negation of diversity is something that people are really into. It's not something that's just some little philosophical thing. They say things like, all dualities must be dropped, and they try to live it. Now, how do they say that you will escape duality? You need to get out of your mind, he told me, out of philosophy, and into experience in meditation. How are you going to find truth? Not through using your mind. You're going to find it through experience. See, the whole existential orientation. You need to meditate, and in meditation you will find reality. And I said, would you please tell me the difference between reality and non-reality, if all dualities must be dropped? He couldn't answer that one. I mean, what is the difference between reality and non-reality? I said, how do you know that what you're experiencing in meditation is more real than what I'm experiencing in my thinking if there are no dualities? Couldn't answer that one. Excuse me. Okay, so begin to get the idea what the problem is here and why they have to deny diversity. They have to deny diversity because philosophically you cannot say that everything that we experience in the creation has come from a simple unity, because then something has gone uphill there. Water has run uphill. The impersonal has produced the personal, and the unity has produced unity and diversity, something which is more complex than itself. Okay, we're going to draw this another way. Told you you'd get this a lot of different ways. Here's the unity. Here's the diversity which we experience as the creation. Or you could say the unity and diversity that we experience as the creation. Now, in Eastern religions, there would technically, there would be no difference between this inside circle and the outside circle, because that itself is a diversity. The distinction between the unity, which is God, whatever they happen to call it, the unity which is God, separate from a diversity which is creation, is in itself a diversity. And so they would not acknowledge that. And you see what kind of thinking that automatically brings about? What's it called? No. Pantheism. Right. Yeah, you were thinking the right thing, but got the wrong word. Okay, pantheism, the idea that everything is God. Now, why do they have to say everything is God? Because there can be no distinction between God and creation if you have no diversity. If you have no diversity, you have no distinction between God and creation, so everything must be God. Everything must be one. That's where you get statements like, all is one, all is God, everything has one essence, everything is an undifferentiated whole, things like that. And you'll find they're almost always very paternalistic in their response to you, you know, very patronizing. They will do things like, I was giving dinner to a guy one time who was a pantheist, and I started talking with him about his ideas, because he mentioned that he believed everything was God. And I started going into it philosophically, and he just sort of reached over while he was eating and sort of patted me on the shoulder, and he said, "That's okay. Once you've had the same experience that I've had, you'll understand that everything is one, too." It took a little bit of control to keep from reaching over his plate and strangling him. And I thought, no, that wouldn't be the right thing to do, would it? Pantheism. Pan means all. See, it comes from theos, meaning God. Pantheism. Or as Francis Schaeffer calls it, pan-everythingism. Because theos comes from an idea of a personal God. And so we're not talking about that. Theos carries ideas of personality with it in the Greek. And this is pan-everythingism. Everything is God. Okay? So all is one. Pantheism. That's one of the ideas that comes automatically from this kind of thinking. If God is a unity, and there can be no diversity, right, coming from that God, then there can be no creation distinct from the Creator. Therefore, everything must be God. That's why they do not use the ideas of create. They don't say God created the world. That word in itself, create, is a Christian word. It's a revelational word. Create means for God to make something separate from himself. In Eastern religions, the idea is not creation, but emanation. To emanate means to give out, like rays of light. A light bulb emanates light. It gives out rays of light. To emanate a creation is the idea that God, as the infinite impersonal unity, has emanated, has sort of given out like rays of light. It's still its own nature, of course. It doesn't change. It is still God. It has given out this creation. And here it is. Of course, there's some inconsistencies there. See? But the problem is, the real problem is, the unity and diversity in the creation seems to be different from their idea of God. So they have to eventually end up denying diversity. Now the idea is like this. The unity is constantly becoming the diversity. In other words, God is constantly becoming the creation, not personal God now, impersonal God. And is becoming the unity again, and then goes back out and becomes the diversity. This is not something that happens sequentially. It is something that happens constantly. It's happening all the time, right now. This unity is emanating the diversity, which is being the unity at the same time, which is emanating the diversity, which is being the unity, which is emanating the diversity. See, it's all happening at the same time. It's happening now, has always been happening, always will be happening. See, it's just that the diversity will be expressed, that what we experience as diversity will be expressed in different ways in the future. And so they talk about things like someday God will wake up and his dream, meaning the creation, the illusion of creation, because of the diversity, see, his dream will go away. God will wake up and this dream will be gone. In other words, that's how real we are. We're just an illusion. See? We're just like a dream. Okay? Or God fell asleep and he dreamed that he was dancing. And the dance became, or the dancer and the dance sometimes, but the dance became the creation. And God will someday wake up and the whole thing will be over. Gone. See? They cannot accept the idea of diversity being real, that diversity is real, because it doesn't fit with their concept of God. See? God is an undifferentiated whole. God can't produce diversity. If God produces something that has unity and diversity, God has made something greater than himself. It doesn't work. See? So then the unity becomes the diversity, becomes the unity. And you've got your little man out here, see? Who's living out there in that diversity, seeming diversity. And he looks at this and he goes, oh, it looks like it's diversified. It appears as if it's diversified, but I guess it can't be that way if God is only one. See? So when you deny diversity, as I said before, you deny your categories. You're basically denying absolutes that can give you things like real right, real wrong, real existence, real non-existence, reality, real illusion. All of those categories are gone because your diversity, differences, have been denied. No categories, no differences between things. Everything becomes one big mesh, okay, philosophically. Now, how does that affect you then in the realm of your metaphysics, morals, and epistemology? If you have no diversity, you have no distinction between what is existent and non-existent. There is no real existence. You cannot know for sure, that's in the epistemological area, of course, that there is existence and non-existence. Do things exist? Or do they not exist? See? The whole area of existence itself. Am I real? Is the chair I'm sitting on real? The whole thing is up in the air because you don't, how can you tell if you're real since it appears as if there's diversity and philosophically you can't have that. So you can't know if you're real or not. See? And then if everything is God and you are God and the chair is God, where do you stop and the chair starts? Is there a difference between personality and impersonality? All those kinds of things. See? In the realm of metaphysics, existence, all of those things, is there a difference between impersonality and personality? If all dualities must be dropped, there is no difference, right? So, if I step on a snail, or squash a rock, break a rock, or shoot you, there's no difference, right? Because there's no difference between personal and impersonal. Then, in the area of morals, there's no difference between good and evil. There is no real right and wrong if all dualities must be dropped. And that was what I was pressing on the person that I was talking to in Amsterdam. So I was pressing on the person. He has this understanding inside, the work of the law of God written on his heart, that he cannot deny as a human being. He can try to resist it, but it's still there. Okay? And so I was working on that, showing him that what he was believing with his mind did not fit with what was going on in reality, trying to show him the inconsistency. Real right, real wrong, well, that's a diversity, so it can't really exist. If all of our choices are an illusion, if we can't know if things are right or wrong, we can't know if things are real or not, how can we... I mean, what's the difference between a good illusion or a bad illusion? Okay? Now, I gave you the logic before, didn't I, about a person who says that everything is an illusion has had to assume that two things are not an illusion in order to be able to say that everything is an illusion? Let's go through that again so that you get the idea, if you haven't got it yet. If a person says everything is an illusion, they have had to assume that at least one thing and maybe two things are real that are not illusions in order to be able to say that, make that statement. First, they've had to assume that they are real. They've done that. They haven't told you that, of course, but they've done that. They've assumed that they are real, and they've probably assumed that their thoughts are real and meaningful and sequential, have some kind of order to them that is significant. They've assumed a number of different things to be real in order to make the statement, nothing is real. And so when a person says to me, everything is an illusion, I say, look, logically, you have assumed that a lot of things are not illusions in order to be able to make that statement. And if they make the statement again, everything is an illusion, I say, look, if everything is an illusion, that means you're an illusion, right? Right. That means your thoughts are an illusion, right? Right. So how do I know your thoughts are true, that everything is an illusion? If they're an illusion. Can you prove to me that that illusion is something I should accept? Well, no, not if it's an illusion thing. They can't do that. And so to say that everything is an illusion, you must have assumed that some things are not an illusion to be able to say it. They cannot escape the reality in which that God has created them to live in. They can't do it. Right? And consequently, for any false philosophy, you will always find a loophole like that. It'll always be self-contradictory because it doesn't start with a sufficient basis, which is the God of the Bible. Okay. And then epistemologically, you have problems. Because how do you know things if there is no difference between one thing and another? I mean, is there real knowledge and is there real ignorance? Is there real knowledge and real illusion, like dreams? What you're thinking right now, is it any different than the dream state that you have? Well, you have no distinction between those two if your diversity is gone. Now, for the last part here, let's look at some results of logically speaking, of this kind of thinking. And these are the conclusions that you will run into that you need to avoid mostly. But we want to see how logically these results come. We've seen how pantheism, the idea that everything is God, comes from this idea of God. If God is only a unit, then there can be no difference between God and creation, therefore everything must be God in the creation. Very simple, very direct, logical step that's taken. If God is a unity, there can be no distinction between the unity and the diversity because that in itself is a diversity, right? And so therefore, the creation must be God. They must be one and the same. So you get all is one, everything is one essence, an undifferentiated whole, or what is commonly called pantheism. Pantheism is a direct result of monism. Okay? Another idea is reincarnation. I should give you another phrase that is close to this but different, that is called the transmigration of souls. Sometimes people will say, oh, I don't believe in reincarnation. I believe in the transmigration of souls. In reincarnation, you can go from one form to another form, and you could be anything. The word reincarnation means to come into flesh again. But the thing is, the words transmigration of souls means basically to go from one human body to another human body. Whereas reincarnation can mean you could become a worm, you could become a cow. I've even heard it said by some people that you could become a rock. And one guy said, well, that wouldn't be so bad. At least you'd be around for thousands and thousands of years. Okay. Who knows if rocks ever get reincarnated again. Okay. So most people will not be serious with the rock part, though, although they might talk about worms and other animals. So when you're reincarnated, it means to come back into flesh again. And what happens is, see, this little man here goes out of the diversity into the unity, and then comes back in again, and that loop right there, from there to there, that loop is what would be philosophically in this system reincarnation. He goes out, he dies, he goes out into the unity, say, and then comes back into the diversity again in another form. Okay? And that's where the idea of reincarnation comes from, is that because you are God, and of course you're going to begin to see inconsistencies between some of the conclusions. So I do not need to be informed. If you see them, that's just fine. Okay. If you have done what is evil, and you go out in, you got bad karma, and you go out into the system, God, you merge back into God again, and then you come back in another form, in a lower form, because you've had bad karma. See, that whole thing is all one system. It's whatever you give out into the system, you get back. That's the idea of karma. Whatever you give out, you get back, because it's all one system. Everything is one. And it's a totally impersonal system. See? That's why there's no possibility for forgiveness. No possibility that your karma can be changed. See? Nothing like that. About reincarnation. The idea of reincarnation then is that because the system is all one, when you die, you simply merge back into the system, and then you're emanated back out into the system again. See, from an invisible form to a visible form. And that's all reincarnation is. You go out into the big mash of God in the universe, and you come back in again. Okay? So it logically follows that because everything is God and there is no diversity, then everything must eventually come back and go over again and again and again, because there's no idea such as creation, making something new. That's not it. The whole system is one and has always been there, simply changing its form. So if you go out, you have to come back in again. See? Now, we must remember that Buddhism is reformed Hinduism. Remember, Buddhism is a form of Hinduism. A lot of people make big distinctions there, but Buddhism is reformed Hinduism. And the Buddha was saying, there is a way, in case you were wondering what I was doing, there was a big insect that was going away. There is a way to escape that whole system. And of course, what he presented was a little bit illogical, but what the Buddha presented was a way by doing good works of escaping the whole system and then going out and becoming part of the whole system and never coming back again, which means that your personality would be eliminated. You'd never have to go through suffering or desire or anything like that again. In other words, you would become impersonal. You would lose your personality, be blended with the infinite impersonal, and never have to come back again. And that is called, being blended like that, is called going into nirvana. And the word nirvana means, sometimes with or without the H, the word nirvana means nothing. Nothing or nothingness. And the idea of heaven here is replaced with the idea of nothingness. Instead of being a place of reward in the presence of God, it is a place of losing your entire personality, so that you lose your identity, you lose your personality, and you are merged back together with the infinite impersonal, so that you don't have to go through suffering and desire in this illusion anymore. Awful, huh? Who would want to be, you know, that to be your final end? See, but the devil would like people to think that that's their final end, so that they don't worry about hell, because there is no hell in this system. Okay? Nothing after death except to come back again. Get another crack at it. Okay, so reincarnation. At nirvana, you have the idea of heaven. Let's replace that. Reincarnation. The idea of dualism. Is very prevalent in Eastern thought. Dualism, the kind of dualism... Carol didn't get to teach on that, did she? No, the kind of dualism is like this. That which is physical is evil, and that which is spiritual is good. Carol has a whole lecture on this and how it's influenced the church, coming out of Greek thought. That which is physical is evil, and that which is spiritual is good. Now, the reason that they say that kind of thing is because the physical world is bound up in all of this diversity. And it looks like it's real when it's not. See, it's really trying to pull the wool over your eyes. reality is really trying to delude you into thinking that it's real. And it's not. It's not really like that. You're being deluded by the idea that things are different from one another, or that not everything is God. You see? And what you need to... Salvation, by the way, salvation in this whole system is enlightenment. It's not a moral thing, it's an intellectual thing. Is that spelled correctly? No, in L-I-G-H-T-E-N-M-E-N-T. Okay. Enlightenment is the idea of salvation, where you finally come to some illumination, some understanding that everything is God, and that you are God, and that there really is no diversity, and that all is one. And when you have that illumination, you are enlightened. And when you're enlightened, then you'll be released from the bondage of this physical world. You'll go out into some other system. Well, the enemy would sure like you to think that kind of thing, wouldn't he? Okay? So, dualism, back to the dualism here. The idea that what is physical is evil. See, this thing is evil, this physical thing, in the Eastern religions, because it is trying to get me to understand or to think that it is real, that it is different than I am. And, so see this stool sitting here contemplating, going, how can I convince this guy? Okay. But it's because this stool is giving me impressions, say, and my impressions of this are wrong, that I need to deny this stool and say it's evil. This thing is bad because it tries to present to me an idea of the creation that is not true. And so they try to deny the physical world, which involves their desires, physical desires. And so part of that denial of the physical world, directly coming from dualism, will be yoga. Yoga is an extreme discipline of the body with the end purpose of trying to come to enlightenment, trying to come to spiritual enlightenment, by denying your desires and disciplining your body so that the physical world will no longer communicate to you that there is diversity and that it is real. And so you will finally come to, and there are different kinds of yoga, of course, but that you will finally come to some kind of enlightenment that everything is God, that you are God, and you have to deny your physical body because your physical body is trying to convince you that it is real and that the things around you are diversified. When it can't actually be that way, it must be an illusion. So yoga is a direct result of dualism. What? Yoga is a severe discipline of the body. Severe discipline of the body with the sole purpose of reaching enlightenment. Having a spiritual experience that shows you that you are God, the things around, everything is one. You're trying to have an enlightenment. Interesting. People in yoga will try to, in different kinds of yoga, will try to raise what they call their kundalini. And that, you know what that literally means? Serpent. Trying to raise their serpent. Yeah, they'll get serpents, okay. You need somebody? Okay. How much time have I got left, Bo? Okay. So then the idea of yoga comes directly from the idea of dualism. You have to deny your physical body and the physical world around you because that which is physical is evil and what is spiritual is good. Meditation is also a part of this, and a specific form of meditation. That is, emptying your mind of conscious thought until it's completely empty, or the only thing that is in it is your mantra. Okay, you have meditation. You can write meditation down. And so you have your mantra. That is something that is sung, said, spoken, chanted. Your mantra can be a complete phrase, a complete paragraph, and usually it's in another language, like Sanskrit or something. Or it can be a word or a part of a word, and most people do not realize that usually what they're doing is calling on a demon to come and inhabit them. And most of the mantras that are given are names or shortened names of gods, Hindu gods, which are, Paul the Apostle said, behind every idol there is a demon. That's why they have power. Okay? So you're calling on a god to come and inhabit you. But the idea of meditation, eliminating conscious thought, is important because it's your conscious thought when you work with your ideas, you work with your ideas, and you think that things are different, that there is diversity, that things are real, okay? Not everything is an illusion, and so you're deluded, or, as they say, you are suffering behind the veil of Maya, which is illusion. You are deluded by the illusion that things are really real. You're deluded by the illusion that there is diversity when there isn't. You're deluded by the illusion that not everything is God when everything is God. And so you need to meditate and eliminate your conscious thought and go into the real world of the spiritual in meditation. Get into the real world and out of this world. Now see where a lot of our phrases during the 60s in the United States came from? This is a plastic world. Where is your head at? Far out. You see? A lot of these terms come right out of Eastern religions. See? Far out. See? Yeah. Someone says, there goes my whole vocabulary. Okay. Where's your head at? Is it in this plastic world? See, this unreal world? Or is it far out? See, it has to be someplace else because if it's here, it's not real because it's part of the illusion here, see? Well, right out of Eastern religions. Okay? So, meditation then becomes important. You must empty your mind of conscious thought, and that's because everything is an illusion and your thoughts are an illusion and they're trying to delude you into thinking that things are real. Okay? Now, karma is also a result of this. Karma, I've told you what this is before. It's sort of a moral cause and effect. Hello? Sort of a moral cause and effect. Whatever you give out into the system, this infinite impersonal system out there, whatever you give out into that, you will receive back again, either in this life or in another life. If you give out good vibrations by doing good things, you give out good karma, then you will receive back good karma later. If you give out bad karma, then you will receive back bad karma. If you're suffering now, it's because of bad karma that you accumulated in the past. Now, this is their idea, of course, of sin, good and evil, and retribution. However, there is no judge in this case, and there is no possibility for forgiveness because it's an impersonal system. There is no personal judge to whom you're responsible, right? The only thing you're working for is your own karma. You're working for yourself. There is no judge in the system. You're working for yourself, and there's no possibility of forgiveness. You cannot change your karma. And so, I was in an airport one time, and a guy walked up to me. I'd just gotten off the plane, so I was tired. I was in my, what a lot of people call my Mike Saya suit. I don't think any of you here have seen my Mike Saya. Anybody here seen my Mike Saya suit? Karen has, I think. Okay. These baggy drawstring pants. I make them myself. Baggy drawstring pants and a really loose-fitting top that I have, that I make myself so that I can just sort of lounge around in. And I like to travel in them because they're very comfortable. You know, they're not restricting, so like when I'm having to sleep in all kinds of weird positions on the airplane, right? So I was walking along in my Mike Saya suit, and this guy comes up to me with a, believe it or not, with a suit and tie and a wig on, and with his Bhagavad Gita under his arm. And he walks up to me, Hare Krishna, see? He walks up to me and he says, you into yoga, man? He looked at my pants, you know, he goes, you into yoga? And I looked at him, I looked at my pants and I thought, well, I'll just get rid of him, just really quickly, you know. So I said, no, if you must know, I'm into Jesus. And I thought that would get rid of him right away. But he kept on walking beside me and talking to me. And I thought, oh, no, I was just trying to get rid of him, see? I didn't want to deal with him because I was too tired. And so he walked on a little while longer, and he said something about, well, you know, Jesus, we accept Jesus too. He's one of the many avatars, you know, he's one of the many saviors, one of the many manifestations of God. You know, no difference between Jesus and Buddha. And he went on to this thing, say, and I said, look, I said, could you walk up to somebody and say, I release you from all of your karma? And I could see the thing inside his head just go tilt, you know, it just didn't fit, you know, in his system. And he said the most interesting thing I've ever heard a Hare Krishna person say. Get this. He said, no man, I'm not God. And I thought, oh, aren't you? You're supposed to be. But he said, see, it just went so out of his system that he just went, you know. I said, can you say to somebody, I release you from all of your karma? He said, no, man, I'm not God. And I said, well, Jesus said that to somebody, so who did that make him? See? What was I doing? Just translating into his terms the statement that Jesus made, all your sins are forgiven. See? Which in the Pharisees' heads went, tilt? Who can do that but God? See? And so it communicated the same thing to him. Okay, now we must rush on. So in karma, there's no hope. There's no hope for retribution. Whatever you give out, you get back. All of these things come directly from the kind of thinking, which is an infinite, impersonal God, a sort of a life force with unity, but no diversity in its being. And you need to think these things through. Now, some of these things are inconsistent with each other. Like karma is inconsistent with Maya. Maya is inconsistent with everything. I mean, why have enlightenment if the enlightenment is all of an illusion anyway? I mean, so a lot of these things are inconsistent with each other, but they all come logically from this kind of thinking. And you need to start with this thinking in your mind, work it through, start with that kind of thinking and see why reincarnation is the result. Start with this kind of thinking, that kind of God, and see why dualism is a result. Start with this kind of thinking and see why karma and maya and emanation are results of that. You understand what I'm telling you to do? You need not just, you know, I'm not giving you an assignment for right now. It'll take you a while to work that through in your head. And you need to work it through, even if you sit down with a piece of paper or a blackboard or whatever, and work it through so that you can explain that to somebody, because you need to be able to show them, yes, it's a logical result, but it comes from a particular idea about God. And that's what I take exception with, is the idea about God. Okay? Now, last thing we want to talk about is the internal and external consistency of Eastern religions. Internal and external consistency. Remember when we were talking about evolution and naturalism? And I said that when a conclusion follows logically from a presupposition, it is a philosophy is internally consistent. When a conclusion follows logically from a presupposition, such as evolution comes from naturalism. If you start out with naturalism, automatically you get evolution. Right? Follows logically, then that is internally consistent within the system. But you must take the conclusion and compare it with the real world that is there, and if it fits, it is externally consistent. If it does not fit, it is externally inconsistent. It doesn't fit with the real world that's there. Got the idea? So if it follows logically, it is internally consistent. If the conclusion fits the real world, it is externally consistent. C.S. Lewis said this. He said, at the final end of everything, I had to be a Hindu or I had to be a Christian, because both of those systems were internally consistent. He didn't use those words. He said they were logically consistent, starting with the particular idea of God. They ended at the right spot logically. He said, the thing that made me become a Christian was history. See? He said, I could not fit Hinduism into history, whereas Christianity fits history at every point along the way. It fits the reality that's there, so it was externally consistent. And so he said, I was drug across the line, kicking, screaming, and struggling by history. That's why he had to become a Christian, because it was externally consistent. And so when we're talking with people, we need to understand. There, now, remember I told you about the guy I talked to in Amsterdam? okay, in Meditation Center. What was I doing? I was pressing on his external inconsistency. Internally, the system is consistent. So what we have to do to show him it's wrong is show him how it doesn't fit the real world. Oh, there are no dualities. There's no difference between pain and non-pain. So it doesn't make any difference if a person in Cambodia is starving to death? Doesn't make any difference if I come and shoot you? Doesn't make any difference? See? What am I doing? I'm pressing on the person's external inconsistency, trying to show them how their philosophy may be logically inside, but it may be logical inside the system, but when you compare it with the real world, it doesn't fit the reality that's there and the things that people experience. It doesn't fit. Okay? Now, there was this last thing is an illustration of this internal consistency. There was a fella in Japan, a Buddhist, and he was studying under a Buddhist master, and the master was trying to get this idea across to him that the world is an illusion. And the way the master was teaching him this idea that the world is an illusion is he said, the world is dew, D-E-W. It's like the dew on the grass. Eventually, the sun's going to come out, it's going to evaporate, and that's it. No more world. It's all an illusion. Nothing means anything. Right? Nothing has any meaning. Well, the guy was doing fine with his philosophy until one of his children died. And he was very upset, and he came to his master, and he said, if the world is due, then why do I feel like this about the death of my child? And the master said, learn the lesson, the world is due. And so he went back and tried to learn that lesson. It was very difficult for him. And then another child died. And he came back again and he said, if the world is due, I don't understand why I feel like this. And the master said to him again, learn the lesson, the world is due. And I forget how many children it was he had, but they died one by one. And then eventually his wife died. And every time he came back to the master, and this time he came back to the master, and he said, if the world is an illusion, if it's just due, I don't understand why I feel like this about losing my wife. And the master said, learn the lesson, the world is due. And Issa, which is what his name was, went away and wrote that this poem, which roughly translated, would go like this. The world is due, the world is due, and yet. You get the point? The world is due, the world is due, and yet. Okay. Expressing how he understood internally that it just didn't fit. What he was being taught didn't fit the real world. It didn't fit his feelings. It didn't fit his understanding of the significance of man, the idea of love in his relationship with his family. It just didn't fit. And we have to remember that a lot of the people that we meet out on the streets are going through that kind of crisis when we meet them. And so we have to be gentle with them and careful when we use the truth and press on them. Press on their external inconsistency. We have to be careful when we press that we don't destroy them with the truth, because the truth can be a very powerful weapon, a very powerful tool, and they've got enough pressing on them as it is. See? They've got enough of that sense of and yet going on in their life. We have to be careful not to press too much reality on them, or we could hurt them with the truth or drive them to suicide or something like that. So we have to try to feel out where they are and try to show them gently why the thing that they're involved in is not satisfying them, is not giving them the answers that they're looking for. And that's why, of course, we have to have it thought through so that we can sometimes, you actually have to teach them what their religion says. See, we have to be ahead of them. That's okay if we claim as Christians to have come to some understanding of the truth through coming in contact with God and the Bible, then we should be able to tell people what's going on in their own heads. We will pray. pray and then we'll stop.